Hello, it's Robin Lustig here, your host for BBC World Drama, showcasing the best drama from around the world. 150 years ago, in 1859, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection was published to immediate controversy and acclaim. Years before the book was published, its author, Charles Darwin, had outlined his theory of evolution to a friend. He said it felt like confessing a murder. Even his wife, Emma, had concerns about the spiritual implications of some of her husband's ideas, fearing they would undermine his Christian faith. In this specially commissioned drama by Craig Baxter, which marks the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, Charles and Emma's own words are used to recreate the domestic context from which one of the world's most influential ideas arose. Alex Jennings and Una Beeson star in Like Confessing a Murder.
Emma, let me read you my beginning. I have attempted to write the following account of myself, as if I were a dead man in another world, looking back at my own life.
Oh.
Nor have I found this difficult, for life is nearly over with me.
Oh, Charles.
It's true.
It's morbid.
I have been most happy in my family, and I must say to you, my children, that when you were very young, it was my delight to play with you all, and I think with a sigh that such days can never return. You all know well your mother, and what a good mother she has ever been to all of you. I marvel at my good fortune that she, so infinitely my superior in every single moral quality, consented to be my wife.
When eventually you asked me?
Oh, I merely, as a man of science, took the time to consider all the arguments for and against marriage before proceeding.
Oh, Charles.
London, 1837. This is the question. Marry or not marry?
My dear Aunt Jessie, when you asked me about Charles Darwin, I did not tell you half the good I thought of him for fear you should suspect something. And though I knew how much I liked him, I was not the least sure of his feelings, as he is so affectionate and so fond of all of us and demonstrative in his manners that I did not think it meant anything. I felt sure he did not care about me.
Mary. Children, if it please God. Constant companion and friend in old age, who will feel interested in one. Better than a dog, anyhow. Home and someone to take care of house. Charms of music and female chit-chat. These things very good for one's health.
He came to see us in the month of August, was in very high spirits, and I was very happy in his company. And had the feeling that, if he saw more of me, he would really like me. Oh.
Forced to visit and receive relations. Terrible loss of time. Not marry. No children. No one to care for one in old age.
He is the most open, transparent man I ever saw.
Freedom to go where one liked.
Every word expresses his real thoughts.
Conversation of clever men at clubs.
He is particularly affectionate and very nice to his father and sisters.
Not forced to visit relatives.
And perfectly sweet-tempered.
And bend in every trifle.
And possesses some minor qualities that add particularly to one's happiness, such as not being fastidious.
Marry and have the expense and anxiety of children. Perhaps quarrelling. Loss of time. Cannot read in the evenings. Fatness and idleness. Less money for books, etc., etc. My God, it is intolerable to think of spending one's whole life like a neuter bee. Working, working, and nothing after all. No, no, it won't do. Imagine living all one's day solitarily in a smoky, dirty London house.
Only picture to yourself a nice, soft wife on a sofa with a good fire and books and music, perhaps.
He came down again last Thursday with Aunt Fanny. And on Sunday, he spoke to me, which was quite a surprise, as I thought we might go on in the sort of friendship we were in for years, and very likely nothing come of it after all.
Marry. Q.E.D.
Emma, would you do me the great honour of consenting to be my wife?
I wish you could have seen dear Papa's tears of joy, for he has always had a great regard for Charles, and Charles looks up to him with the greatest reverence and affection. There was a large party in the house, but I believe both Charles and I looked very dismal, as he had a bad headache.
And how should I manage all my business if I'm obliged to go every day walking with my wife? I never shall know French, or see the continent, or go to America, or go up in a balloon, or take a solitary trip in Wales.
I was so glad to find that everyone had been wishing for it and settling it. It is a match that every soul has been making for us, so we could not have helped it if we had not liked it ourselves.
Never mind, my boy. Cheer up. There is many a happy slave.
We shall live in London, where he is fully occupied with being secretary to the Geological Society and conducting a publication upon the animals of Australia. I am so glad he is a busy man.
My dear Emma, like a child that has something it loves beyond measure, I long to dwell on the words, my own dear Emma. There never was anybody so lucky as I have been, or so good as you.
My dear Charles, do you think I do not ask myself many times a day, what is he doing now?
I wish the awful day was over. I am not very tranquil when I think of the procession. I have been very extravagant and ordered a great many new clothes. Mr. Stewart wanted me to have a blue coat and white trousers, but I vowed I would only put on clothes in which I could travel away decently. I want you very much to come and take charge of the purse strings, as I have already bought several things which I do not much want. I have got the ring, which is the most important piece of news I have to tell.
I am very glad you resisted the blue coat. You would have looked very unnatural in it. The white trousers were no great temptation in this weather. I wonder what extravagancies you have been committing.
I must have one more letter signed Emma Wedgwood. Forever after, it will be Emma Darwin. Oh, I won't forget the ring, and do not you forget to keep a bed for me, or lose the license. Goodbye, my own dear Emma.
How my head will stand it when I am really Mrs. Darwin, I can't tell.
About the time of our marriage, I was led to think much about religion. I had gradually come to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, with the Tower of Babel, the rainbow as a sign, etc., etc., and from its attributing to God the feelings of a revengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted.
We now do belong to each other, but I fear that our opinions on the most important subject differ widely. Your mind and time are full of the most interesting subjects and thoughts of the most absorbing kind. But may not the habit in scientific pursuits of believing nothing till it is proved influence your mind too much in other things which cannot be proved in the same way, and which, if true, are likely to be above our comprehension? Will you do me a favour?
Yes.
I am sure you will. It is to read our Saviour's farewell discourse to his disciples, which begins at the end of the 13th chapter of John. It is the part of the New Testament I love best. For I have given you an example, that ye should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you,
the servant
is not greater than his Lord. Amen. I should be most unhappy if I thought we did not belong to each other forever.
Home, home.
Oh, it's so cold. Oh, let's go and get warm.
My dear Mama, the house here is blazing with fires and looks very comfortable. And we are getting to think the furniture quite tasteful. I have been facing the cook in her own region today and found fault with the boiling of the potatoes, which I thought would make a good beginning and set me up a little. I can't remember what we did on Saturday, except walking about a good deal and meeting a pianoforte van in Gower Street, to which Charles shouted to know whether it was coming to number 12, and learnt to our great satisfaction that it was. I have given Charles a large dose of music every evening.
I was thinking this morning how on earth it came that I, who am fond of talking and am scarcely ever out of spirits, should so entirely have rested my notions of happiness on quietness and a good deal of solitude. I think you will humanise me and soon teach me there is greater happiness than building theories and accumulating facts in silence and solitude.
I believe from your account of your own mind that you will only consider me as a specimen of the genus. Oh, I don't know what. Simia, I believe. You'll be forming theories about me, and if I'm cross or out of temper, you will only consider, what does that prove? Which will be a very grand and philosophical way of considering it.
What an awful affair a confinement is. It used to knock me up almost as much as it did Emma herself. My first child, William Erasmus Darwin, was born on December the 27th, 1839.
It is a little prince. My little animalcule of a son. Yes.
And I at once commenced to make notes on the first dawn of the various expressions which he exhibited, for I felt convinced, even at this early period, that the most complex and fine shades of expression must all have had gradual and natural origin.
Oh, dear. Shush, 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 oh, baby.
During first week, yawned, stretched himself just like old person, chiefly upper extremities, hiccuped, sneezed, sucked.
My dear Aunt Jessie, I am quite well and strong, and now able to enjoy the use of my legs and my baby. And a very nice-looking one it is, I assure you. He has very dark blue eyes and a pretty small mouth. His nose I will not boast of, but it is very harmless, as long as he is a baby.
Evidently subject to tickling.
At his eighth day, he frowned much.
If frowning has any relation to vision, it must now be quite instinctive.
The baby performed his first smile today.
But certainly not from pleasure.
A great event.
Merely a chance movement of muscles without a corresponding sensation. Emma argues that his smiles were from seeing her face.
Because a tassel dangling did not make him smile.
Yes, 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 yes. Oh.
6 weeks and 4 days, smiled repeatedly, and I think chiefly when suddenly seeing face of mother and mine.
Yes.
Annie was born in Gower Street on March the 2nd, 1841. Her first smile was a true smile, indicative of pleasure. Her eyes brightened and her eyelids slightly closed. At 2 months and 4 days, she had a little noise of pleasure, very like a laugh.
Who wants one of these? Do you want one, Willie? Yes? Are you going to give one to Annie? Is that good, Annie? Is it good? Does that taste good?
Little Annie has taken to walking and talking for the last fortnight. She is 13 months old and very healthy, fat and round, but no beauty. Willie is very much impressed with his own generosity and goodness to his sister.
Annie was today rather amused at a wafer sticking first to one hand and then to the other as she tried to disengage it. And I remember Willie, about the same age, grew frantic with passion at a bit of wet paper thus sticking to his fingers.
Ow!
Oh, Charles.
Oh, my confounded stomach.
Oh, let me help you. Sit.
Oh, God.
I'm afraid you'll be laid up if you fight against it any longer.
Oh, confounded. It is almost worthwhile to be sick, to be nursed by you.
Whilst living in London, I attended, as regularly as I could, the meetings of several scientific societies and acted as secretary to the Geological Society. But such attendance and ordinary society suited my health so badly that your mother and I resolved to live in the country, which we both preferred and have never repented of. Oh. July the 22nd, 1842. We have moved all our goods and chattel to a house I have purchased in the small village of Down, near Farnborough in Kent, a quiet, most rustic spot on the chalk. There are 18 acres with the house, which is tolerably good, and I've got them very cheap. It is very retired. Indeed, I do not think I ever walked in so retired a country. I am a different man in strength and energy to what I was in the old days on board the Beagle. I have not had one whole day, or rather night, without my stomach having been greatly disordered during the last 3 years, and most days great prostration of strength. Many of my friends, I believe, think me a hypochondriac. Our two little souls, Annie and Willie, are better and happier, which likewise applies to me and to my good old wife.
What have you found?
Some specimens that appear to me quite curious.
I thought you were bringing me flowers.
Well, yes, I suppose I am.
My life goes on like clockwork, and I am fixed on the spot where I shall end it. Years before we came to Down, being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence which everywhere goes on from long-continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it struck me that under certain circumstances, favourable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavourable ones to be destroyed. The result of this will be the formation of new species. Anxious to avoid prejudice, I determined not for some time to write even the briefest sketch of it, but after our move to Down, I allowed myself the satisfaction of writing a very brief abstract of my theory. There is a simple grandeur in the view of life that from so simple an origin, through the process of gradual selection of infinitesimal changes, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been evolved.
There is Papa. Look, he's working. Look at him. Charles.
Mm-hmm.
There is only one subject in the world that ever gives me a moment's uneasiness. I do hope that, though our opinions may not agree upon all points of religion, we may sympathise a good deal in our feelings on the subject. Shall we leave Papa in peace? shall we? Come on. Off we go.
My dear Hooker,
over the years, I have always expected to hear a torrent of objections to anything proposed from my good friend, the botanist, Joseph Hooker. But I have found he is so candid that he often comes round in a year or two. Early on in our friendship, in January 1844, I made a confession.
My dear Hooker, I have been engaged in a very presumptuous work, and which I know no one individual who would not say a very foolish one. I was so struck with distribution of Galapagos organisms, etc., etc., and with the character of the American fossil mammifers, etc., etc., that I determined to collect blindly every sort of fact which could bear any way on what our species. At last, gleams of light have come, and I am almost convinced, quite contrary to the opinion I started with, that species are not. It is like confessing a murder. Immutable. I think I have found out, here's presumption, the simple way by which species become exquisitely adapted to various ends. You will now groan and think to yourself, on what man have I been wasting my time in writing to?
The short outline of my theory complete and stored safely away, I began to work on Cirripedia, my beloved barnacles. I worked steadily on this subject for the next 8 years, though I record in my diary that about 2 years out of this time was lost by illness.
Oh, Charles. Sit down, Charles.
All this winter I have been bad, and my nervous system affected, so that I was not able to do anything 1 day out of 3. I thought I was rapidly going the way of all flesh, but having heard accidentally of 2 persons who had received much benefit from the water cure, I got Dr. Gully's book.
The Water Cure in Chronic Disease by James Manby Gully.
And made further inquiries.
An exposition of the causes, progress and terminations of various chronic diseases of the digestive organs, lungs, nerves, limbs and skin.
Dr. Gully feels pretty sure he can do me good.
We really are going to set out bag and baggage to Malvern as soon as Charles is well enough. It is a great trouble taking all the household, but we think he could not give Dr. Gully's treatment a fair trial under 6 weeks or 2 months, and that would be too long to leave the children, even with their aunts. We both feel very hopeful that it will be of some use to Charles, though we do not venture to hope a cure.
June 1849, Malvern. I have been here for 3 months under Dr. Gully and the cold water cure, which has had an astonishingly renovating action on my health.
We have got a very comfortable house with a little field and wood opening onto the mountain for the children to play in.
Annie, catch!
Oh, no, I went behind that tree.
Annie, don't go too far into the woods.
Willie!
Before 7, I get up and am scrubbed with a rough towel in cold water for 2 or 3 minutes, which makes me very like a lobster. It is most curious how the violent excitement of the skin produced by simple water has acted on all my internal organs. I mention all this out of gratitude to a process which I thought quackery a year since. How I shall enjoy getting back to Down with renovated health, if such is to be my good fortune, and resuming the beloved barnacles. Dr. Gully, the cruel wretch, has made me leave off snuff, that chief solace of life. My dear Hooker, we have left Malvern and are back at Down, but I shall have to go on with the aqueous treatment at home for several more months. I have built a douche in the garden and am to go on through all the winter, frost or no frost. My treatment now is lamp 5 times per week and shallow bath for 5 minutes afterwards. Douche daily for 5 minutes and dripping sheet daily. The treatment is wonderfully tonic, and I have had more better consecutive days this month than on any previous ones. I'm allowed to work now 2.5 hours daily, and I find it as much as I can do. For the cold water cure, together with 3 short walks, is curiously exhausting. I steadily gain in weight, and Dr. Gully thinks he shall quite cure me in 6 or 9 months more.
Oh!
Children, please. Your papa is trying to rest.
What excellent sport!
When we first moved to Down, Charles and I talked over together what we should do. The house was newly and expensively furnished. Shall we make the furniture a bugbear to the children? Or shall we let them use it in their plays? We agreed together that as they must be within doors a good deal, we would not worry about things getting shabby. So chairs and other furniture used to get piled up for railways and coaches just as the fancy took them.
Ow!
Are you all right, Etty?
Up you get. Come here, come here.
There. I believe we have all been much the happier in consequence.
Emma is uncomfortable all day long and seldom leaves the house, this being her usual state before her babies come into the world. She will be confined of our number 8 in May. Is this not a dreadful number? A precious lot of young beggars we are rearing. March 1851. Malvern. I have brought my eldest girl Annie here. She inherits, I fear with grief, my wretched digestion. Most regular medical men sneer at the water cure, but I have tried it repeatedly and always with wonderfully good effects. April the 17th, 1851. Thursday, 4 o'clock. My dearest Emma, I am assured that Annie is several degrees better. Her face lighted up, and she certainly knew me. Dr. Gully is most confident there is strong hope. Thank God she does not suffer at all, but half dozes all day long. I implore you, Emma, do not think of coming here in your condition. Yours, my dearest, Charles.
Dearest Charles, no wonder Annie brightens up at your sight. You are always the tenderest of human beings to her, and have comforted her so on all occasions. It is a blessing that our darling does not suffer.
Friday, 12 o'clock. Dr. Gully slept here last night and is most kind. Annie's pulse has ceased to intermit, and that encourages him a little. Before that, he did not think she would last out the night. Today, he says she is no worse, and at present, this is the best which can be said. It is now, from hour to hour, a struggle between life and death. We give her spoonfuls of gruel with brandy every half hour.
How kind of Dr. Gully to sleep in the house. I should think a spoonful of raw yolk of egg beat up in hot water and a little salt might be a change when you can venture.
7:30. Dr. Gully has been, and thank God he says he yet has hopes. Positively, he has hopes. Oh, my dear, be thankful. 4 deluges of vomiting she has had today, poor thing.
Poor little sweet child.
Saturday. You would not in the least recognise her with her poor, hard, sharp, pinched features. I could only bear to look at her by forgetting our former dear Annie. There is nothing in common between the two. I cannot express how it felt to have hopes last night at 11:30 when Dr. Gully came, saw her asleep and said, "She is turning the corner." I then dared picture to myself my own former Annie, with her dear, affectionate, radiant face.
Papa.
Sweet child.
Annie has just said papa, quite distinctly. 2 o'clock. We expect Dr. Gully every minute. but he is fearfully overworked with 88 patients. Annie takes a tablespoonful of gruel every hour and no physic. All trace of fever is now gone. 3 o'clock. The doctor has been. He says she makes no progress. She has taken 2 spoonfuls of tea with evident relish and no sickness, thank God. 5 o'clock. Just the same. Annie has rallied, has passed good night. Danger much less imminent.
Oh, your message is just arrived. What happiness! How I do thank God. I was in the garden looking at my poor darling's little garden to find a flower of hers. The waiting for post time is the worst, but one gets used to everything in a degree, and now I have so much more hope. I hardly dare think of such happiness.
Sunday. We had to get Mr. Coates, the surgeon, to draw Annie's water off. She struggled with surprising strength against being uncovered, but it evidently relieved her. I do not sit all the while with her, but am constantly up and down. I cannot sit still. These alternations of no hope and hope sicken one's soul. 12 o'clock. Again she has vomited and complains of fatigue rather more. I was moving her when she said, "Don't do that, please." And when I stopped,
Thank you.
I wish you could see her now, the perfection of gentleness, patience, and gratitude. Thankful till it is truly painful to hear her. Poor dear little soul. How it did make me cry to read of your going to Annie's garden for a flower.
My dear Charles, I feel today very awful. It is a dreadful period for all of us, but except at post time, my sufferings are nothing to yours.
Monday. After Dr. Gully left yesterday at 7:30, we bathed her with vinegar and water, and it was delicious to see how it soothed her. I told her I thought she would be better, and she so meekly said,
Thank you.
Her gentleness is inexpressibly touching.
Your minute accounts are such a comfort, and I enjoyed the sponging our dear one with vinegar as much as you did. Poor darling. I do think, looking at the accounts of the last 4 days, that there has been progressive improvement from that time. I have been thinking about a few slops that might suit her when she can take a little food. If the bowels should be too loose, I believe rice, boiled for many hours till it loses shape and the solid part drained away, is a very good innocent food and binding. It perhaps might be flavoured with cinnamon or currant jelly. Willie is very eager to hear how Annie is every day, and though I tell him all the changes, I don't think he realises the real fear.
She has slept most tranquilly almost all afternoon. Perhaps too tranquilly. We have changed the lower sheet and got her bed flat, and a little pillow between her 2 bony knees. She looks quite nice and is certainly now going on very well.
The oftener I read over your letter of Monday, the more hopeful it makes me. Tuesday. Wednesday. Thursday, April 24th. My dearest, I know too well what receiving no message yesterday means.
My dearest Emma.
Till 4 o'clock, I sometimes had a thought of hope. But when I went to bed, I felt as if it had all happened long ago.
She went to her final sleep most tranquilly, most sweetly, at 12 o'clock today. Our poor dear, dear child has had a very short life, but I trust happy. And God only knows what miseries might have been in store for her. She expired without a sigh. How desolate it makes one to think of her frank, cordial manners. I cannot remember ever seeing the dear child naughty. God bless her. We must be more and more to each other, my dear wife. Do what you can to bear up, and think how invariably kind and tender you have been to her.
Your letter has just come, and you give me the only comfort I can take in thinking of her happy, innocent life. She never concealed a thought, so affectionate, so forgiving. What a blank it is. Poor Willie sends his love. He takes it and cried quietly and sweetly. My feeling of longing after our lost treasure makes me feel painfully indifferent to the other children and our unborn babe. But I shall get right in my feelings to them before long. My dearest Charles, you must remember that you are my prime treasure, and always have been. My only hope of consolation is to have you safe home to weep together. I feel so full of fears about you. I can't bear to think of you by yourself. Oh!
Annie was my favourite child. Her cordiality, openness, buoyant joyousness and strong affections made her most lovable. Poor dear little soul. Well, it is all over. The day before yesterday, Emma was confined of a little boy. Her pains came on so rapidly and severe that I could not withstand her entreaties for chloroform and administered it myself, which was nervous work, not knowing from eyesight anything about it or of midwifery. The doctor got here only 10 minutes before the birth. I thought at the time I was only soothing the pains, but it seems she remembers nothing from the first pain till she heard that the child was born. Is this not grand?
Good day to you, sir. Good day.
We have done little else but cry together and talk about our darling Annie. I think everybody loved her. I do feel very grateful to God that our dear darling was apparently spared all suffering. And I hope I shall be able to attain some feeling of submission to the will of heaven. From her having filled our minds so much for the last 9 months, it leaves such an emptiness. I hope it will be a very soothing operation, looking after a young baby.
May he turn out a naturalist.
March 1852. I am at work on the second volume of the Cirripedia, of which creatures I am wonderfully tired. I hate a barnacle as no man ever did before. Not even a sailor in a slow-sailing ship. Confound and exterminate the whole tribe. I can see no end to my work. What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horridly cruel works of nature. Emma has been very neglectful of late, and we have not had a child for more than one whole year. She is, thank God, right well. And so are all the chicks.
Mr. Lewis has made a sliding board for the children, and they enjoy it very much. They put it on the stairs, and even I have taken a slide or two.
Whoa! Emma, be careful.
No, not again.
Children are one's greatest happiness, but often a still greater misery. A man of science ought to have none, perhaps not a wife. For then there would be nothing in this wide world worth caring for, and a man might, whether he would is another question, work away like a Trojan. From September 1854, I devoted my whole time to arranging my huge pile of notes, to observing, and to experimenting in relation to the transmutation of species. I collected facts on a wholesale scale by printed inquiries. My dear Huxley, I really am much obliged to you for looking at my preparations. Extensive reading and by correspondence with skillful breeders and gardeners. My dear Gray, I scarcely ever like to trust any general remark in zoology without I find that botanists concur. My dear Hooker, forgive me for my negligence in not having sooner answered your letter, but Emma has just been confined of our sixth boy.
Look.
Baby is small for his age and backward in walking and talking, but intelligent and observant, and he is of a remarkably sweet, placid and joyful disposition.
He is particularly fond of standing on one of my hands and being tossed in the air. He makes a little pleased noise and then looks at me with a wicked little smile. I began in 1856 to write out my views on the species question fully. Yet I got through about half the work on this scale when my plans were overthrown early in the summer of 1858. My dear Dr. Gray, it is very unlikely, but if by any chance you have my little sketch of my notions of natural selection and would see whether it or my letter bears any date, I should be very much obliged. I am sure it was written in September, October or November of last year. Why I ask this is as follows. Mr. Wallace, who is now exploring New Guinea, has sent me an abstract of the same theory, most curiously coincident, even in expressions. And he could never have heard a word of my views. So all my originality, whatever it may amount to, will be smashed. I should be extremely glad now to publish my general views. But I cannot persuade myself that I can do so honourably, knowing that Wallace is in the field. And I fear we have a case of scarlet fever in the house with baby. Three children have died in the village, and others have been at death's door with terrible suffering. It is miserable in me to care at all about priority. I always thought it very possible that I might be forestalled, but I fancied that I had grand enough soul not to care. But I find myself mistaken and punished. You will be most sorry for us when you hear that poor baby died yesterday evening. I hope to God he did not suffer so much as he appeared. He became quite suddenly worse. It was scarlet fever. It was the most blessed relief to see his poor little innocent face resume its sweet expression in the sleep of death. Thank God he will never suffer more in this world. Poor Emma behaved nobly. How she stood it all, I cannot conceive.
The poor little baby was born without its full share of intelligence. We were infinitely tender towards him. But when he died in the summer of 1858, aged 18 months, after our first sorrow, we could only feel thankful. He had never learnt to walk or talk.
In September 1858, by the strong advice of my scientific friends, I set to work abstracting the manuscript begun on a much larger scale 2 years previously, and completed the volume on the same reduced scale. It cost me 13 months and 10 days hard labour. It was published under the title of The Origin of Species in November 1859.
Charles's book is done and he is enjoying leisure, though he is a very bad hand at that.
My book has stirred up the mud with a vengeance. The Bishop of Oxford, one of the most eloquent men in England, has ridiculed me at great length.
I wish Charles could smoke a pipe or ruminate like a cow.
I have read lately so many hostile views that I was beginning to think that perhaps I was wholly in the wrong. It will be a blessing to me if all my friends do not get to hate me. My old tutor Sedgwick says I am deep in the mire of folly, having attempted to break the link between the material and the moral.
He is right to say there is a moral part of nature as well as a physical.
I only state scientific truths as I have discovered them, and I leave it to the theologians to reconcile them with the scriptures. That is their province, not mine.
Listen.
But I cannot see, as plainly as others do, and as I should wish to do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seems to me too much misery in the world. I am inclined to look at everything as resulting from designed laws, with the details, whether good or bad, left to the working out of what we may call chance. Not that this notion at all satisfies me. I feel most deeply that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect.
You're playing beautifully. Good.
A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton.
The Lord God made them all. Each little flower and herb, each little bird that sings.
An innocent and good man stands under a tree and is killed by a flash of lightning. Do you believe that God designedly killed this man? Many or most persons do believe this. I can't and don't.
Shall I play now?
Yes!
Yes!
If the deaths of neither man or gnat are designed, I see no good reason to believe that their first birth or production should be necessarily designed. I am conscious that I am in an utterly hopeless muddle. My dear Gray, it is now 6 months since I have done a stroke of work. The vomiting is not now daily, and on my good days I am much stronger. My head hardly now troubles me, except singing in the ears. I send a photograph of myself with my beard. Do I not look reverent?
I have taken a little to gardening this summer, and I often felt surprised, when I was feeling sad enough, how cheering a little exertion of this sort is. I like cutting and carving among the shrubs.
Emma!
But as my opinion is diametrically opposite to the rest of my family, I don't have my own way entirely in that matter.
Where is the Times?
I have given it up, on principle.
But to give up the bloody old Times, as Cobbett used to call it, is like giving up meat, drink and air.
I've changed it for the Daily News.
Which I find rather dull.
April 28th, 1866, London. Dearest Aunt Fanny, our last days here have been so pleasant and successful that I must write you a scrap. Charles went last night to the soiree at the Royal Society, where assemble all the scientific men in London. He saw every one of his old friends and had such a cordial reception from them all as made it very pleasant. He was obliged to name himself to almost all of them. as his beard alters him so much.
Though I am a strong advocate for free thought on all subjects, it appears to me that direct arguments against Christianity and theism produce hardly any effect on the public. And freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds, which follows from the advance of science. I may also have been unduly biased by the pain which it would give some members of my family if I aided in any way direct attacks on religion. I am thinking, though, of writing on the origin of mankind, as I have been taunted with concealing my opinions.
I think Charles's new book will be very interesting, but that I shall dislike it very much, as again putting God further off.
Fetch, Polly! Good girl!
The tendency in savages to imagine that natural objects and agencies are animated by spiritual or living essences is perhaps illustrated by a little fact which I once noticed. My dog, a full-grown and very sensible animal, was lying on the lawn during a hot and still day. But at a little distance, a slight breeze occasionally moved an open parasol, which would have been wholly disregarded by the dog had anyone stood near it. As it was, every time that the parasol slightly moved, the dog growled fiercely and barked. He must, I think, have reasoned to himself in a rapid and unconscious manner that movement without any apparent cause indicated the presence of some strange living agent. And no stranger had a right to be on his territory. I cannot look at the universe as the result of blind chance. Yet I can see no evidence of beneficent design, or indeed of design of any kind, in the details. As for each variation that has ever occurred, having been preordained for a special end, I can no more believe in it than that the spot on which each drop of rain falls has been specially ordained. The old argument of design in nature, which formerly seemed to me so conclusive, fails now that the law of natural selection has been discovered. The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us, and I, for one, must be content to remain an agnostic.
Good day, Mr. Worm! Mr. Worm!
Charles has taken to taming earthworms.
They take not the least notice of the shrill notes from a metal whistle or the deepest and loudest tones of a bassoon.
But does not make much progress, as they can neither see nor hear.
Loudly as possible!
Indifference. We may conclude worms do not possess any sense of hearing.
Wait. My wife and self have our game of backgammon every evening. She threatens me sometimes if I triumph too much. She, poor creature, has won only 2,490 games, whilst I have won, hurrah, hurrah, 2,795 games. Out, hurrah!
Charles. I have been reading over our old letters. There are not many. We've been so seldom apart. And never, I think, for the last 15 or 20 years, which have been the happiest, as I am sure they have been the most overflowing in tenderness. Oh, forgive me. Oh, I had not realised you were working. I would not have spoken.
Forgive you?
I can declare that in my whole life I have never heard you utter one word which I had rather have been unsaid. You have been my greatest blessing.
Oh. If he is too busy to speak to me, tell my dear husband I cannot say how happy he makes me and how dearly I love him and thank him for all his affection, which makes the happiness of my life more and more every day.
Bless you, my dear wife. I wanted to show you. Do you recall the letter I received in Hebrew from the Polish rabbi?
Oh, you sent it to be translated.
I have received the translation, and the rabbi says, among other things, he says he thanks me for my work on evolution and that it is the best elucidation of Genesis he has ever come across.
Oh, Charles!
You know, I think that is the best bit of praise I have ever received.
So, are you replying to the rabbi?
No. I shall, but no. The children have been asking me to write down some autobiographical recollections for some time.
Yes.
I thought I should make a start. Here, let me read you my beginning. Mm-hmm. I have attempted to write the following account of myself as if I were a dead man in another world looking back at my own life. Nor have I found this difficult, for life is nearly over with me.
Oh, Charles.
But it's true.
It's morbid.
I have been most happy in my family. And I must say to you, my children, that when you were very young, it was my delight to play with you all. And I think with a sigh that such days can never return.
Like Confessing a Murder was compiled and dramatised by Craig Baxter, with assistance from the Darwin Correspondence Project at Cambridge University. Charles Darwin was played by Alex Jennings. Emma Darwin was played by Una Beeson. The Darwin children were played by Sophia and Gabriel Saban, Eve Bannister, Joseph and Ellen Clayton, Tara Taylor and Betsy Owen. The pianist was Una Beeson. Technical presentation was by Jerry O'Riordan, Mickey Taylor and Simon Owen. And the play was directed and produced by Penny Borum and Ruth Evans. Like Confessing a Murder was a Ruth Evans production for BBC World Service.